This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
It actually pains me now when I see what's happening in America. It pains me when I see what's happening in certain countries in Europe and indeed some parts of our own country. I just being there and seeing that actually most people, despite all the problems, are trying to do the right thing. I think it'd be an absolute tragedy if we lose that.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to another edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week farmers started to seriously worry about the future, Medway faces its financial future, and the government gets involved in a major housing development in Swale. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by multimedia reporter Gabriel Morris, who's been looking after a Medway council this week.
Hello.
Daniel Esson, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hi.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who's been looking at the national and international picture for us.
Hello.
And later on, we will be speaking to Liberal Democrat veteran Peter Carroll. He will talk to us about the art of political campaigning. Gabriel, you've been looking after Medway in the absence of Robert Boddy, who's heading to Manchester.
Yes, I have. And this week we've heard a lot of numbers to do with the financial state of Medway Council. Well, officers have warned the authority it's very likely to go bankrupt without drastic changes, as they predict an overspend of £11.2 million. This is largely due to a £9.7 million overspend in the Children and Adult Social Care Department. Now, the full budget comes in February, but ahead of a council meeting next week, an early budget has been released in a bid to mitigate the risk in hopes of having early discussions with central government for more funding. The report predicts that next year the cost of children and adult services will increase by £16.2 million as a total of £340 million, as largely due to demographic growth projections predicting more people requiring the services. The fear is if action isn't taken, they might have to issue a Section 114 notice, or that effectively declares the council bankrupt and the government will have to intervene. Several authorities across the UK are currently having to do this, such as Thurrock, which is on the other side of the Thames, to us here in Kent.
So, Gabriel, what would this mean for residents?
But the authority has said they might need to immediately stop some or all non-essential services, limit spending to the legally required minimum levels, freeze recruitment and use reserves. The report says some of these measures would have to be taken immediately. The draft budget asked members of the council's cabinet to work to find more savings to reduce the shortfall and also to coordinate with central government about funding and what was already being promised so far earlier this year. One of the measures we've already seen taken is the cutting back of free swimming sessions for under 16s and cutting of funding to some events in the towns.
And what have you been looking at then, Dan?
So I've been away in my winter retreat, that being the floor of Swale Borough Council's planning committee, in the company of Gabriel, as it happens. Yeah, again, watching them fret over very large housing developments, but this time it didn't go entirely as they planned.
Okay. Firstly, what's the deal with the estate itself and how big is it?
So it's called Highstead Park. It's made up of 8.4 thousand homes. I'm pretty sure it's one of the biggest housing developments in the country. It would wrap around the south and east of Sittingbourne, pretty much absorbing a load of villages in the process and going all the way up to Tenham. It's a project by Quinn that's been in the work for God knows how many years. The football club, who stands to get a new ground of it, are very much in favour. But over 700 letters of objection were sent to the council about it, and council officers were actually recommending that members vote to reject the very unpopular plans.
So what happened at the meeting then?
As you'd imagine, pretty much every parish council within a few miles sent people to speak against it. But literally only 3 hours before the meeting started, the planning department received a letter from the Department of Local Government on behalf of Angela Rayner, saying that the power of decision was being taken away from Swale Borough Council and that there would instead be a public inquiry run by the government, with the Secretary of State Angela Rayner making the final call. I'm pretty sure that's the first housing development that the new government have called in to a planning inspectorate appeal. They've done it with energy projects and stuff, but not with houses. But as you can imagine, councillors are not particularly enthused about this.
So what do you think will happen now then? Do you reckon it'll be approved by?
Well, the inquiry will take a while. I'd guess maybe 3 months from now there'll be a result. And it basically runs like a planning committee but run by the government. But yeah, for what it's worth, I reckon Angela Rayner will approve it. Swellborough Council doesn't have a local plan. They've chosen to delay releasing a local plan, you know, twice now in the past couple of years. So I reckon the government will say, well, you can't prove to us that you're going to build the houses you need, so we'll make you build them. What have you been looking at, Simon?
Well, Gabriel and I have been spending some time out in the countryside looking at in depth at the effect of the Labour budget announcement on inheritance tax on the local farming community.
So obviously, most people pay inheritance tax. Why is it different for farmers and what do farmers think about this change?
Well, it means for the first time farmers will have to pay 20% tax on the value of their land and property over a 1 million quid threshold. But considering the size of many farms in Kent, I mean, they are on paper worth, you know, many, many millions of pounds. It means that they won't be able to necessarily easily pass their inheritance on to the next generation without being clobbered with a massive bill. But they could pay that off over a period of time, or they can maybe sell some of the land in order to put some money aside to pay the bill when it comes in. But the argument is that they would possibly make the farms unviable and they could end up being sold off. So what we were trying to find out was essentially, well, what's going to happen to all this land should the worst happen? We also met up with the Conservative MP, Katie Lamb, who says that the effect on the farming sector could be existential. And more than one farmer that we spoke to talked of possible potential suicides among the older generation as a way of bypassing the tax.
I mean, what's the fear that will happen to this land, you know, if it's not farmed?
Well, it's a great unknown. I mean, people can only guess. But most people see it being broken up into vast mega farms, sort of, or swallowed up by huge corporations for carbon offset purposes, but more likely the countryside will just be carpeted with more housing or solar farms, and some farms may survive as small holdings, but the tradition of passing on farms to the next generation does seem to be seriously in doubt. The opponents to it, and that's most of the farming sector, many people in ancillary rural professions are hoping that if the noise is loud enough across the country, in Kent, the government might amend, soften, or even scrap the inheritance tax altogether. Nikki, what's been catching your eye this week?
So Ashford Sojan Joseph was the Kent MP asking questions at PMQs this week, and he's been asking for a commitment from the government to tackle the mental health waiting lists. As someone who works in mental health nursing for many years, it's a subject that's close to his heart and one he's obviously determined to keep in the spotlight. So Keir told him the government had recognised the devastating impact mental health problems have on people's livelihoods and that people were waiting simply far too long to be seen. And also there's been a shocking decline in children's mental health. That's something that they've noted too. The Prime Minister said the government was giving mental health the attention it needs by recruiting 8,500 mental health workers, and that they're also looking to reform the Mental Health Act, which in his opinion is something that's long overdue. Also on health, raising health issues this week has been Maidstone MP Helen Grant, who's been talking in a debate in Parliament about younger women with breast cancer. Some people will know that Miss Grant was diagnosed with breast cancer last year after she had a standard NHS screening check, so she knows only too well the importance of such checks and the screening. She's since had a full mastectomy and reconstructive surgery, but she's keen to make sure and encourage others that they get checked or check themselves on a regular basis, as we all know that with any cancers, early detection is a key in successful recovery. As it stands, mammograms are not usually available on the NHS to women under the age of 50, yet a tenth of new cancer cases are for patients between the ages of 25 and 49. And she says she took part in the debate because she thinks it's absolutely crucial that age does not prevent an early diagnosis.
Any of the other Kent MPs out there making a name for themselves?
Yeah, Dartford MP Jim Dixon is back on track issues again. He's been asking the new Labour administration to look at all possible options to bring the latest tube services to Dartford and Ebbsfleet. A debate took place in Parliament on Tuesday where MPs discussed the pros and cons of extending the £19 billion link, which opened in May 2022, east from Abbey Wood and into North Kent. Mr Dixon told Westminster Hall there was a discrepancy between the number of Crossrail services north of the Thames compared to here in the south. And while his constituency isn't one that's a London borough, they are people in Dartford are very much dependent on transport links into the capital, as are many more of us a bit further beyond. So he's gone on to call on the government to finish the job and extend the Elizabeth line out to Ebbsfleet. He says that investment in transport infrastructure, like the extension of the Elizabeth line and the Lower Thames crossing, which is another one of his favourite issues, can kickstart the economic growth in the region. Now, he's not alone in his thinking. Several supporters say an extension to Ebbsfleet will bolster links to the area, where at the moment there's 15,000 homes being built. And it also provides an interchange with HS1 high-speed services between St Pancras and the Kent coast. Now, you might scoff at the idea, but it isn't simply a pipe dream. The original plan for the Crossrail route would have seen it end in Ebbsfleet, but that section was dropped in 2004 because of costs and difficulties with it sharing tracks with South Eastern and the rest of the National Rail network. Also, on his side is Dartford Council leader Jeremy Kite. He thinks extending the line to Dartford would be a good idea. Not good news at the moment. Rail Minister Simon Lightwood told Mr Dixon there are currently no plans to extend the line, but never say never. The proposed 16-kilometre route from Abbeywood to Gravesend and Hoo Junction was safeguarded back in 2008 by an Act of Parliament, so it could still be on the table.
Okay, thank you very much.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Peter Carroll Fallon lost three general elections for the Liberal Democrats and has proved himself as a master tactician in political campaigns. Does anyone remember Joanna Lumley's Justice for Gurkhas? What about Anne Barnes becoming the first Kent Police and Crime Commissioner? Along the way, Peter has been a special advisor in the coalition government, and for good measure, he's been an RAF officer and ran a haulage and logistics business. All that and much, much more. Welcome, Peter Carroll, to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Thanks for having me. We're very happy to be here.
Good. Thank you very much indeed. The one thing I do know about you, Peter, is that you never stop and you've always got some project on the go. You've kind of dropped out of politics a little bit, or visibly anyway. What are you up to these days?
Well, having served as a special advisor in the Treasury towards the latter part of the coalition government, I was working for a Lib Dem minister, now Sir Daniel.
Yeah.
And when the party had such a disastrous general election result in 2015, I was faced with a choice, basically. I'd to earn a living, so do I go and get a job working for a big city lobbying firm or PR firm, or do I start something myself? And I'd formed a very close friendship with a colleague in the Treasury, and we were both of the same mind. We said, why don't we do something? We've been lobbied very well over the last number of years, and we've been lobbied very poorly. We've seen it done well, seen it done badly. Why don't we start our own outfit to do mostly what you wouldn't call good cause type campaigning on behalf of charities, organisations? We also do business work too, and we decided to do that. So we started something called Tendo Consulting, started it on the 8th of June 2015, and it's been going ever since. That's what I'm doing now.
Does this sort of the corporate stuff pay for the good cause type stuff?
Generally, there is more in the corporate world,
yep,
to help support some of the good causes, because by their nature, very often, some of the most worthy campaigns and causes have the least behind them. And that can be absolutely heartbreaking. So, you know, to not be able to do something because there's no funding there is really quite difficult.
Tell us a little bit about your background. Where do you come from, and where did you grow up, etc.?
I'm born in Stockport, a satellite town, I suppose you could call it, of Manchester, way back in 1960. Born in a council house, very loving parents. Dad was a fitter in a local engineering factory, very active in trade unions, very often on strike, very often in trouble with the employers, and nearly always fighting the good fight for his fellow workers who he felt had been treated poorly. And my mum was a dinner lady at the local school just down the road, and a fantastically happy childhood, very, very loving parents, and managed to do pretty good at primary school, past what was then the 11 plus, off to grammar school and then off to university. I think certainly first person in our road to go to university.
No.
That's a little bit about where it comes from. I remember sitting on my dad, literally sitting on his shoulder during various trade union meetings that were held in our front room in our house in Stockport, and that's where I began to pick up how politics works and how people feel about issues. And I suppose that's been with me ever since.
I wanted to ask Pete, obviously you say you sort of grew up in and around the trade union movement because of your father. And that's the same kind of story a lot of people in the Labour Party and on the left tell. Were you at any point attracted to the Labour Party or anything further left? So, what drew you towards the Liberal Democrats rather than the party traditionally associated with the unions?
Well, I was attracted to Labour, and in my teenage years, I did go to quite a few Labour meetings in the local branch, and it was in an era of particularly savage infighting in the party between what I would imagine you'd call the very hard left and the more centrist parts of the party. If I remember it correctly, I think my MP at the time was Tom McNally, and I think there was moves to push him out. It's such a long time ago, it's very hard to remember all the specifics, but it felt like quite a toxic environment. And I was very quickly of the opinion, based on my own reading and having various conversations with my dad and other people that came to see him, that the hard left didn't appeal to me at all. I think in politics, the extremes are both equally unattractive. And because of that, and some promising signs in what was, I think at this time, still the Liberal Party, because it, as you know, it went through various manifestations before it became what we call the Lib Dems now, I decided more of a centre ground. But for many years, I wasn't involved too much in politics because, as Simon said at the beginning, I joined the RAF in 1984, and obviously you can't have an overt political leaning and be an officer in the armed forces at the same time.
Mm. What was it like? It must have been a bit of a culture shock, life from a council estate, sort of ending up in the RAF, especially as a commissioned officer.
It was quite. I mean, I felt that actually before the RAF. I felt it at grammar school. I'll never forget going to grammar school. I mean, it had a stripy blazer. The uniform was a stripy blazer and a cap with circles on, and you had to wear shorts and carry a satchel.
Yeah.
On the road I lived in, I might as well have had a target put on my back, kind of stuck out a bit. And going to grammar school, everybody's dad was a doctor, a dentist, architect, and it felt a bit different, a bit strange. I remember one person telling me that they were going to a gymkhana, and I kid you not, I actually thought that gymkhana was a person. I thought there was a bloke somewhere called Jim, and his surname was Khana. It was in the RAF, I felt it a little bit too. I mean, you had to go to a tailor to have your suit, your uniform. Well, I'd never been to a tailor. My mum used to take me to C&A in Stockport Town Centre and always buy me clothes that were at least one size too big. Shoes were always two sizes too big so I could grow into them. That felt a bit odd. And I remember being chastised also because in the officer's mess the first few times, I put my cup down on the table, not on the saucer. Yeah, at home we didn't have cups and saucers, we had mugs. So I'm actually acutely aware, because one of my passions in life is I think people have enormous talent, irrespective of their background. It might be in politics, it could be in music, it could be dance, science, maths, whatever. And I do think that some of the barriers to them getting on are not always educational. Some of them are these cultural feelings, you know, where people feel that they shouldn't be there, a bit imposter syndrome-y. But yeah, I've experienced that, and it's not great, but it can be very funny.
Tell me a story once about when you were in the RAF and only ironing one side of your shirts.
Yeah, well, I joined the RAF on the 5th of February 1984. You'll probably gather that the ability to remember that so specifically after such a long time is the sign of what a savage experience turned into. I joined because I hadn't left home to go to university. I went to my local university, Manchester. So after a couple of years working as a scientist locally, I thought, I've got to do something. I've got to cut the apron strings. So I joined the RAF. Oh, my word. Was that a culture shock? I mean, I was just, to be honest, I was homesick. I was disorientated. Everybody was shouting at me all the time. And in the first 6 weeks, we had to do this amazing cleaning routine and discipline routine, which I now understand is part of the whole process of building self-discipline, self-reliance, teamwork. But you had to clean your room obsessively, and you had to iron your clothes obsessively and hang them in a certain way, in a certain wardrobe, with a certain space between each hanger. And I thought, God, this is too much. So with my five RAF shirts, I thought, what I'll do is I'll iron just the front half of them, so they're end on in the wardrobe. So I ironed them all so that they thought somebody looking in the wardrobe, the drill sergeant inspecting your room, would think he's ironed them all. And I got away with it for a couple of weeks. But then one day I'm stood to attention at 6:30 in the morning in the middle of Lincolnshire at RAF College Cranwell. Stood to attention. He comes in the room, does the classic white gloves over the top of the door frame, the window frame. And then he looks at the wardrobe. And I've got to say, the bit that was facing him was good.
you could cut red with the crease on the sleeves of those shirts. But there must have been some instinct in him, because he took out his long cane that they carry under their arm and flicked the hanger off. And I thought, oh, Jesus. Because the other side of the shirt looked like a melted crisp packet. Well, my friend next door, Julian, who I lost contact with tragically, he came up with a trick. What he used to do was he did his room, made his bed, put starch on the bed, then ironed it, and then went and slept in the car. So he slept in the car for about 10 days. And I used to look at his room and think, how the hell does he do? But that's what he was doing. He was sleeping in the car. Looking back, it's funny, but at the time, I was...
That would be honest, so it wasn't the least bit funny. What was your punishment for doing that then?
Oh, 50 press-ups and generally treated as an undesirable object. Looking back, it was fun, but at the time, I just thought, oh, I'm not going to survive this.
No, but sometimes, yeah, that's just... you can look back on these things with a certain amount of fondness, but perhaps it wasn't really good at the time. Just moving on to your sort of your political career, you at some point you moved to Kent, where you were running a haulage business, and you decided that you were going to focus on the Folkestone and Hythe constituency, where Michael Howard, Lord Howard as he is now, was the MP and had been the MP for quite some time. Why did you pick that particular constituency? Because, you know, looking at all the constituencies post-1997, it was, although the majority was small, it was pretty solid. I mean, why choose that one? Why focus on him?
Well, I had originally had a look at Eastbourne, and I tried to get on the list at Eastbourne, in fact, but I wasn't deemed to be... appropriate or suitable. I didn't like make the list for that. I think part of that was because I didn't really understand, don't like using the expression the game, but some of politics is a game in the sense that there's ways of doing things and ways of not doing things. So I didn't really manage my approach to that very well. So next on the list was Folkestone. I was given some guidance by someone I had a lot of respect for in terms of, I can never say the word, what's that long word that begins with a P about elections? Pathology, is that right?
Sepology, yeah.
Yes, even that one. And it looked like there was a strong Labour vote of about 10,000. The Lib Dems had got about 15,000 last time. And Michael, now Lord Howard, had about 20,000. So you could look at it and say that if somebody put a very energetic campaign together, really threw themselves into it, you might be able to persuade the Labour voters to come across, add to the Lib Dem voters and therefore get a majority over the incumbent Conservative.
Mm.
It had a very unpleasant title at the time, which I never liked. It was called the decapitation strategy.
I remember that. Well, Charles said that he wasn't it, that he had the decapitation strategy.
Yeah, I mean, Charles helped me quite a lot in my various campaigns. I thought he was a lovely man. I actually think, I know there was a drink problem, but to be honest, I think even when he'd had a drink, he was a better politician than a lot of politicians these days. And I mean that in a kind way.
Yeah, I know, I do. I've never heard anyone say a bad word about Charles Kennedy, I have to say, over the years. So it wasn't to be. And you had another go, didn't you? I seem to remember.
Yeah. I fought Folkestone and Hythe in 2001, 2005. There were some particular local issues in the Folkestone and Hythe area that anybody associated with local media, I'm sure, will remember.
Yeah, I do remember, yeah.
Where the local council didn't go too well. So in 2010, I had a go at the Maidstone and the Wheel constituency because I'd worked, my haulage business was based in Maidstone. I'd lived in Maidstone for a few years as well. So I felt I had some connection to the seat.
She understood it, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, to jump in, Helen Grant, just for the listeners, I mean, was the candidate who was going to take over from Ann Widdecombe. Ann Widdecombe was an incredibly popular Conservative MP, and waiting in the wings was Helen Grant. She didn't expect to get to have any kind of a challenge mounted of any note. And so just talk us through what actually happened then, Peter.
Well, I like to think that when I do a campaign of any kind, I throw my heart and soul into it and use every skill I can to advocate for that campaign. I mean, you very kindly said at the beginning I had a political career. Actually, that's the biggest problem I've had, is despite the campaigning experience, and some would kindly say track record of winning campaigns, that didn't apply to the three I actually fought to try and get in. But when I went to Maidstone, I was coming off the back of again, people have very kindly said was a very successful and powerful campaign, the Gurkha Justice campaign that Joanna Lumley, I asked her to come in and lead from the front, and she did that. So I'd got quite a high regional profile I'd actually done quite a bit of national media as well. So I went there and I threw the kitchen sink at it. On some days I had 200 retired Gurkha soldiers delivering leaflets, and boy, can I tell you, retired Gurkhas can deliver leaflets at a frightening rate. So I think maybe the Conservative team there were at least aware that there was a credible and forceful challenger in the shape of myself and the team I built. But it was not to be. I think, I can't remember the scores in the doors. I think I got 17,000 votes, and Helen Grant managed to hold on to the Conservative vote that Anne Widdecombe had secured for many years. And I came second, and in politics, horrendously and cruelly, there's no prize for second.
Okay, well, that was 2010. I suppose if you were a Liberal Democrat and you were in the party looking to get a turn, win a seat in 2015, you'd probably just kiss your chances goodbye. So you decided, and you'd had the Gurkha campaign. So that obviously gives you the taste for campaigning. Could you just talk us a little bit about why the Gurkha justice campaign was so effective? I mean, you and I knew each other during that period, and I worked in Folkestone, and anyone who lives in that area will know that there's a very big Gurkha presence, and they're much respected, well thought of, but there was this injustice that was going on. Can you just explain to the listeners what that was about?
Well, the injustice, in simple terms, was that Gurkha soldiers had fought with the British Army for 200 years-ish, and they have, in any military circles, a legendary reputation for ferocity in battle, comradeship, loyalty. They have an almost indefinable sense of humility with all of that as well. They have a great sense of community, and anyone who has served with the Gurkhas or whose relative serves with the Gurkhas, there is, and it's not an overstatement to say this, I think there is an emotional attachment, a love and respect for the Gurkhas. Bizarrely, despite that, despite the great record of service, despite how the public regard Gurkhas and retired Gurkhas, the rules were that once the Gurkhas had done their 16 years or 20 years or 22 years in the army, they had no right to live in Britain afterward. In fact, not only did they have no right, but they were required to go back to Nepal. Simple as that. Many of them wanted to stay in Britain and do jobs. They wanted to be security guards, bus drivers, open restaurants, taxi drivers, but they just couldn't. And there was one, I was contacted by a local councillor in Canterbury who said that he heard this story that some retired Gurkhas were anxious about a friend. The friend was called Tej Limbu, and he'd been arrested and forcibly taken to Dover to be deported. And I thought, well, because at that time I didn't really know about, I knew about the Gurkha service and how they were regarded, but I didn't understand the rules and this ban on staying in the UK. And I was really outraged by that. Within a few days, four retired Gurkhas were in the front room of my home where I still live, explaining to me what had happened. And I genuinely felt, put all politics aside, all party politics, it was like a disbelief. It was just disbelief. How can this be? So I researched it, and from that moment on, I resolved to try. And it felt, at the time, an impossible task. I felt I need to do something. I need to put a campaign together where we change the rules. We persuade the government to change the rules. And that was the birth of the Gurkha Justice Campaign. Went through some incredible highs, incredible lows. Getting Joanna Lumley involved was the equivalent of getting a nuclear weapon. And she was devastatingly good.
Her father had been an officer in the Gurkha regiment. Yes. And she was born in Kashmir, I think, wasn't she?
Yeah. There was one moment in the campaign which will live with me forever, even bigger, I think, than the day we won and it was announced by the Home Secretary in the Houses of Parliament. And it was this. Joanna, there's a really funny story, actually, because when Joanna phoned, she left a voicemail message and didn't say who it was. So when I jumped in my car, I was halfway back from Yorkshire on some haulage business work, and I dialed 121 to get my messages, and there was a lady's voice saying that something, could I ring her, and bloody, and I thought, oh, it's going to be a bit of casework in Cheriton, because at that time I was a local councillor. And I rang the number, and as I was talking to her, I thought, we know within a few seconds, you think, I know that voice. And basically what she said was, you've been trying to get in touch with me. My agent's passed the number on. Tell me what the issue is. I told her. And she said, Peter, I'll be with you to the end, which was great. First day in the campaign, and this is the moment that will live with me forever. She said to me in that phone call, there's one thing I would like to happen, if at all possible. My father's life was saved
by a Gurkha soldier. And he gave me a picture of that Gurkha soldier when I was a little girl and said, "This is the bravest man you'll ever meet." If there was any chance at all that I could meet that Gurkha if he's still alive, it would mean the world. So we found the Gurkha, Tul Badaher Pun, VC, Victoria Cross. So on the first day she joined the campaign, we got all the media, local, regional, national, international. We'd gone to the High Court, and I'm walking up the steps at the High Court, surrounded by flashlights and cameras and microphones and 1,000 retired Gurkhas, a cacophony of noise. We get to the top step just before you go into the main arches of the High Court, and there is Tul Badaher Pun sat in his wheelchair. She bends down to greet him, and he reaches up, touches the side of her face, and says, "I remember your father. It's as if you're my own daughter."
Wow.
That was the moment.
Mm.
The other, I liked to hear from her eye. And at that moment, you really sensed that this was more than immigration. It was more than party politics. This was about something really, really special.
I suppose the other moment people might remember is when Phil Willis was cornered by Joanna Lumley and harpooned by niceness. And the poor man just didn't know where to put himself, because he was basically, "You are going to do this, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes." But I mean, off the back of that that campaign, you then, I remember meeting you with Anne Barnes, who was going to be the non-political independent candidate for the very first Kent and Police Crime Commissioner's job.
Yeah.
And you got involved in that. I mean, what happened there that you got yourself involved with Anne?
Well, I think because I'd done the Gurkha Justice campaign, I'd also been involved in another campaign called Fair Fuel UK, which was about trying to stop the ceaseless increases in fuel duty on petrol and diesel. I'd also done quite a bit of animal welfare campaigning on tigers, and I'd done my local attempts to become an MP, though unsuccessfully. But I think the campaign was powerful enough, particularly in Maidstone, that people had a sense that I knew at least some things to do right in the campaign. And I was approached by Anne to see if I would help run her campaign. And I initially declined. I think I declined 3 times, but she was very persistent. And in the end, I thought, well, why not? Because I actually do believe that police and crime commissioners should be politically independent. I'm not a fan of political parties holding those kind of positions. Even, I'm from a Liberal Democrat heritage. I still think, on balance, I'd rather see independence than any party political representation in that role. And
but you made that, you made that her point of difference. And that was part of the campaign. And the other thing that you did, from memory, because I covered this thing incredibly closely at the time, was you got out of the blocks so quickly before anyone had even thought about getting a candidate, much less sort of, punting them around the studios and getting information out and leaflets out and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I seem to remember the Conservatives took such a long time to choose Craig McKinley, now Lord McKinley, that they were so far behind that they'd lost even before they started.
I think there was another thing at play as well in that campaign, and it was, Kent has traditionally been very conservative when you look at the representation on local councils, the county council, and typically the MP. I know it's changed quite a lot recently in this recent election, but certainly in the era that we're talking about, you would describe Kent as heavily conservative.
Yeah.
I felt that the Conservative Party, the agents, the candidates, were all a little bit complacent, perhaps. And I just used some of the techniques that I'd learnt the hard way in both my political campaigning and my more public interest campaigning. I remember one, we decided to target the postal vote, and we managed to get about 50,000 people, I think, in Kent voted by post, and we got a letter to them all within 48 hours of each other.
But that was the key thing. That was the one thing that everyone said was the masterstroke. It's probably, you know, old hat now, but at the time it was considered a bit of a thing. If you could get a letter on the doormat the day or the day before or day after the postal vote had arrived, your chances of getting that person's vote were so much higher, given the fact that Anne Barnes had such an incredibly high profile to that point.
Yes, yes, that's right. I mean, most people do that now, but at the time it was a bit more in the creative stakes. And not only does it yield a higher
engagement from the voter. In that election, I think most of the people that voted actually voted by post because the turnout was very low.
It was, yeah.
So it's easier to vote by post. So if the turnout's low, it would suggest that you can win or lose it by targeting the postal vote, which is the rationale we went through. But we had great fun on the campaign. I mean, Anne had said to me that she had a very powerful team of people around her, and it was at her local amateur dramatics club.
That's right, yeah.
And I remember that, yeah. There is a film in there somewhere, a bit like Calendar Girls, because taking these lovely people who had never done anything political and turning them into a force that could beat the Conservative Party in Kent over a period of 10 weeks, that was probably one of the most fun things I've ever done.
Yeah, it was actually funny because on the day of the election, you were with Anne in Sandgate Road in Folkestone, and I was coming back from Asda, and you were then there in the street, and I said hello to Anne and all this, and you had a look on your face, and I said to you, "You've won, haven't you?" And you sort of said, "Not saying anything, but I think we're going to do all right."
You took every single district, from what I can remember.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I remember an exchange with a local reporter from one of the broadcasters at the count, where he said, "Why are you smiling?" And you may know this, Simon, and your colleague Dan, because you've covered these things before. But when the boxes are tipped out, we geeky type, we can count them as they're tipping out on the paper. So in your mind, you've got a rough idea of how it's looking. And the moment I saw the first four boxes, I knew we'd won. But of course, you can't say that because, you know, you'd be breaking the rules.
Sadly, we're kind of running out of time. But I just wanted to ask you very quickly. First of all, you went on then to become a special advisor to Danny Alexander, who was the Liberal Democrat Chief's Chief Secretary of the Treasury in the coalition government. What was that like? I remember speaking to you at the time, and you find that working in Westminster, not obviously as a politician, but as an advisor, someone within the apparatus, that you said that it was the most bizarre kind of job you've ever had.
Well, it was. I mean, everything about it was zero to 100 miles an hour in an instant, suddenly from being outside of the machine to being right at the heart of the machine, to see how it actually really works, how senior politicians, cabinet ministers work, how they relate to each other, how decisions are made, and have to cope with the most amazing scrutiny. I was there to help him with his media profile based on all the stuff I had done. In fact, I think I was so annoying to the Treasury on the fuel duty stuff that's probably what made him invite me to go in. In fact, the permanent secretary to the Treasury was the most senior post. He was a bit of a legend, Sir Nicholas McPherson. He's now Lord McPherson. But he greeted me on the second day and said, "Oh, nice to see you in. I think you've cost the Treasury about £56 billion in the last 2 years. And I thought, well, that's a bit sharp. But what a character. So yeah, it was an amazing experience. And one of the things that it left me with, it confirmed, I've always believed that actually doing things in politics is a good thing. Most people go into it with the best of intentions. And we've got such a fantastic country, even now with all the problems and the stresses and the economic ups and downs. And there's a hint of division now, maybe more than ever before. But still, fundamentally, it's a fantastic country, a great society capable of so much more. And to be at the heart of it, where even you can influence it in a tiny way, it's actually a privilege and it's an honour. And I just hope we don't drift in further down this track where, oh, all politicians are terrible and politics doesn't work and let's just rant and rave and become more divided and more extreme, drift more left, drift more right. It actually pains me now when I see what's happening in America. It pains me when I see what's happening in certain countries in Europe and indeed some parts of our own country. I just being there and seeing that actually most people, despite all the problems, are trying to do the right thing. I think it'd be an absolute tragedy if we lose that.
Good intentions of politicians aside, Peter, do you not think maybe, you know, there's a sense among the public that all politicians are the same and people hate them because for, you know, many, many decades, politicians basically haven't listened to them. And sadly, that does also mean the coalition government, which spent plenty of time, you know, sort of butchering the public sector in the name of balancing budgets. And after 14 years, what has anyone got to show for it? Surely you have to appreciate there are pretty good reasons why the public don't like or trust politicians.
I do. I think that's a very fair point. And just for the record, there were certain things that the coalition government did which I profoundly disagreed with. Like when I went to university when they had grants, I think the breach of trust on tuition fees was very, very, very bad indeed. And I do get it. What I'm frightened of, though, is most things that you need to sort out in life are quite complicated. It's boring, but it's true.
very few things are simple. And when people get frustrated, what they tend to do, I think, is they think, oh, to hell with all of you. You're all the same. I'm now going to vote for X, where X just says, yeah, we can sort that. We can do that. Yeah, we'll cut, we'll get rid of income tax and we'll put a fence around all our borders. And we'll make lots of jobs in Britain. Yeah, just vote for us because we can do that. When actually they can't because they don't know how to and it's not possible to do what they're doing.
Mm.
So the skill, taking your point down, I think, is that politicians do have to listen more and they do have to respect people who say, actually, I feel nervous. Some people on immigration feel nervous about it. There's a class of politician who say, well, you shouldn't feel nervous about it. You're wrong to feel nervous about it. And that's what drives them away. And on the economy, the same. You can't say to people, well, you know, it's tough times, so you just have to have it really, really tough when you've got billionaires who are not paying their fair share.
But getting that balance right is pretty tricky.
Very finally and quickly, if you don't mind. Sir Ed Davey is, you know, sitting on, I think, the most Lib Dem MPs ever. Can he turn the Liberal Democrats into the main opposition party?
Can that be done?
I think it can be done. I think that what may very well happen is that the party that will help him the most to do that may well be the Conservative Party.
Mm.
Because I fear they may be about to move in certain directions because of what they perceive as the threat or competition from Reform, which will...
It gives you the ability to move over to the centre-left, or centre-right rather, doesn't it? I think there was an acknowledgement that the Tories did lose a lot of votes to the Lib Dems, and in the same ways the Tories would have conceded that they lost a lot of votes to the Green Party, believe it or not. So there is a sizable body of people who would normally vote for Conservatives who are quite prepared to move that little bit further over to the left or the centre because they don't want to go too far to the right.
Indeed.
And
that very interesting time.
Mm.
The third part of the FOS system is obviously a major factor in this.
Well, I mean...
Major factor.
Well, it's a major factor. How many MPs would you have got? You'd have got fewer MPs in that case than Reform, if that had been a different, the PR system. But there you go. That's the thing. As you say, we did a very interesting time. But Peter, listen, we could sit here and chat here for hours, and it's been so good of you to give us the time that you have. And it's always been a pleasure to speak to you, as always. And thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
Okay, well, listen, just before we go, I just thought we'd want to pick up on one or two little things that we were talking about earlier, and particularly what Nikki was saying about the Elizabeth line coming to North Kent. This is clearly something that is going to be promoted by the local MP, Jim Dixon. You've watched this thing fairly carefully, Dan. What do you think is the likelihood of all that?
I'd like to think it will come, not least because I spend an awful lot of my life on trains, but I sincerely doubt it. It seems like it would probably be a very large and expensive infrastructure project, the kind of thing which the government... doesn't seem to have any particular appetite for, and as all the recent revelations about HS2 show, the British state is basically incapable of building anything new without money, power and responsibility disappearing in literally every single direction. And I don't think current government have any means to change that, so they as much as the local MPs may request it, I don't think the rail minister will ever give permission for that kind of thing to start, not least because it would end up costing them loads of money. They don't have the political will to justify that expense.
Okay, and is there some movement on the Lower Thames crossing?
Yes, they have announced the long-awaited seventh round of consultations for local stakeholders to give their views after many, many, many years working on the Lower Thames crossing. It goes on until about December. I think last we heard, the new government said that they were meant to make a final decision. They delayed making a final decision until next May, I think it is, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier related to the Elizabeth line and new railway services in North Kent. I'll stake my credibility, and though you're not meant to make predictions, I reckon the new government will scrap the Lower Thames crossing in May. Well, if not beforehand. Next announcement on the Lower Thames crossing, if it isn't another round of...
Which is due in May, yeah.
Yeah, they'll scrap it, I reckon.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Dan, Gabriel, and our special guest, Peter Carroll. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. You can also sign up for our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters/. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online And you can watch The Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.